You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, conservatives have been critical of the media's handling of Hunter Biden's business dealings in Ukraine and China. We'll look at how mainstream news outlets and social media have been dealing with the ongoing story and the responsibilities they have in covering campaigns. Now, Judge Amy Coney Barrett will go to the full Senate for a vote on whether she should be the next American Supreme Court justice. Republicans on the Senate Judiciary Committee voted her through unanimously this morning. Missing from the vote, Senate Democrats, they boycotted the proceeding. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How closely have you been following the confirmation procedure? How important is this to you? Do you like the nominee as the next Supreme Court justice? Do you think changes might need to happen in the U.S. Supreme Court? Is this a voting issue for you? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Charlie Jacobs is a professor of political science at St. Norbert College in De Pere, specializing in public law, judicial process, and American politics. Charlie, welcome back.
Thanks, Rob.
Well, all right, not a lot of drama. I think people knew that this was going to pass the committee this morning. Democrats, I guess, added some excitement by not showing up. What do you make of this morning's vote?
I think that the Democrats felt as though they were cornered. They don't really have any parliamentary or procedural maneuvers to make. And sitting there and watching the proceeding unfold and then just casting their votes, I think wasn't going to be as dramatic for them as the approach they took here, which was ineffective in the sense that they were going to lose the vote either way. But I think at least it's creating for the Democrats some theater that they can use from now until the election. And of course, they can use it as a vehicle next Monday when they have, the full Senate take up this this nomination and the vote. So it was kind of their last best option for them because they're in the minority and they don't really have very many tools in their toolbox to try to affect a different path for this nomination.
Let's give a listen to the majority. Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina, Republican, chair of the Judiciary Committee. Here he is talking to C-SPAN after today's vote.
The committee did the right thing. The judge deserved a vote up or down. Democrats chose to participate in the hearings, so to ask her hard questions. I think they owed it to her to show up today and vote her yes or no. They made a decision. I made a decision. It'd be wrong to deny Judge Barrett a chance to be confirmed on the floor of the United States. Senate, to the American people, you have somebody highly qualified, a judicial disposition that should be the gold standard, and somebody that will apply the law, not a personal agenda.
So Democrats still pointing back to Merrick Garland, Judge Merrick Garland, not getting a vote, not getting even meetings with Republican senators in his ultimately non-successful, non-confirmation process. Compare and contrast, Charlie.
Well, I mean, the stance that the Republicans and Lindsey Graham have taken since the opening happened several weeks ago has seemed to, be strident about the power of the president to be able to make this nomination. And, their irony meter seemed to not be well calibrated because some of the things that he said just seemed to fly in the face of the arguments that they made when Obama had the chance to fill a slot with the passing of Justice Scalia. So it's interesting to me that there is a certain brazenness to what Lindsey Graham was saying, because he has to recognize that the words that he was offering, were just so contradictory. And as Chuck Schumer had said earlier in the day, completely hypocritical to the stance that they had taken when Obama was in office. And so I think that's why the Democrats are making hay with the argument that this is a raw power grab. That's the kind of language that they've been using, and that this is going to be detrimental to the politics on the Hill. We're already in a polarized situation. We have the parties at their throats with each other on these kinds of public policies. And this is only going to entrench the bad feelings even more. And, it's funny because you left off sort of one last little phrase that Lindsey Graham offered, which was he has never seen anybody more capable in his time in the Senate, which I just found interesting because he's also been there when Roberts, Alito, Sotomayor, Kagan, Kavanaugh and Gorsuch all went up. So it was sort of interesting that he picked her out like that as sort of the leading light that he's had to confirm while he's been in the Senate.
Let's give a listen now to Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer of New York, outside the room, speaking outside the Capitol.
We are voting with our feet. We are standing together. And we are standing against this unprecedented mad rush to jam through a Supreme Court nomination just days before an election.
That said, the author doing is standing outside and talking. As you said, Charlie, there is nothing they can do really to stand in front of the process.
No, and you know, to be honest here too, is there's a certain hypocrisy on the Democratic side because, of course, they made the claim that Obama should have the absolute right to make these kinds of appointments, and they were upset when Merrick Garland was denied that opportunity. And of course, they flipped their position now that they are in the other seat. So, you know, it's interesting to see the desperation in the Democrats here. It's not unexplained. I mean, there's a reason for this desperation. But I think that there are avenues that they can take after this election if Joe Biden happens to win. And if it happens that both Joe Biden win and the Senate flips to the Democrats, I think that Chuck Schumer and others are going to be pushing for some changes and reforms to this entire process or the judicial branch itself.
Yeah, so that raises the issue. Some Democrats calling on, if that happens, Democrats win the White House and the Senate, to add justices, so-called court packing. Now, candidate Joe Biden says, he says he wants to form a commission, a bipartisan commission, to look at some kind of reforms to the judicial system. What are your thoughts on the prospects for changes that could actually get agreed upon?
Well, I think that Joe Biden has been around politics long enough and he knows his history well enough that he knew the hurdles that Franklin Delano Roosevelt had to try to get over in his court packing scheme. And it didn't end well. I mean, in the sense that FDR got all of the policies he wanted out of an unreconstructed court, the whole idea of court packing blew up in his face. And I think that Biden is cognizant that that could happen. And you certainly don't want that in the first couple of years of an administration if he gets elected. I think that the commission might serve a purpose in this way. I mean, the public might be averse to the idea of packing the Supreme Court. But, you know, we've seen some need at the lower courts, in particular the appellate courts, for some additional judges. We have not added a single judge to the circuit court since 1990. And when we did, we only added 11 to bring the total up to 179. And you have to remember, they have a big caseload. I mean, since 1990, it's gone from about 40,000 to highs in the 60,000s today. So I think what Biden could do and what the Democrats could do is say, well, we're not going to pack the Supreme Court, but we're going to start to add some needed positions. Of course, Biden would have the opportunity to make those nominations. And because the appellate courts deal with so many cases that never make it to the United States Supreme Court, they could have an effect on the output of law from American courts.
We're talking about the Supreme Court confirmation progress of Judge Amy Coney Barrett with political science professor Charlie Jacobs from St. Norbert College. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What are your thoughts on the nomination, the process, the timing of it? And what do you want to know about how Judge Barrett, if she's confirmed as a Supreme Court justice, could affect key issues that could come before the court, that will come before the court, including the Affordable Care Act? You could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time.
This week on Beta, the Nationals frontman, Matt Berninger, talks about his debut solo album, Serpentine Prison.
I'm often writing songs I wish other people would write to me, you know? Like, I'm always imagining what would be the sexiest song someone would write about me.
Saturday at 11 on the Ideas Network.
There are many things to enjoy in Wisconsin in every season of the year. Wisconsin Public Radio is here 365 days a year to serve you with informative, thought-provoking programs. Thank you to WPR members whose support makes it all possible.
Whether you laugh along with Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, or feed your mind with To the Best of Our Knowledge, you'll always find something to enjoy on Wisconsin Public Radio. Find our program schedule and listen online at WPR.org.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk about today's committee vote on the Supreme Court nomination of Judge Amy Coney Barrett with St. Norbert College political science professor Charlie Jacobs. You can join in with your thoughts and reactions at 800-642-1234. We'll go to your calls now. Jim is with us in Dubuque. Jim, hi.
I just want to say I approve of Judge Barrett. Although the Constitution is already somewhat a dead letter, I think it's helpful to get someone who respects the principles and intentions of the Founding Fathers.
Jim, thanks a lot for the call. And there's the issue of originalism, how much we try to put ourselves, I guess, in the mindset of the crafters of the Constitution. That's been a long-running issue for the court system, right, Charlie?
It has. I mean, the notion of originalism, and that captures a whole bunch of different ideas, has been sort of prominent in the debate about the way in which we interpret both the Constitution, but also statutes for the last 40 years or so. It's not that new. I mean, certainly we see it raised as a point as early as the 19th century, in the very early 19th century. But someone like Barrett is very much an acolyte of Scalia, for whom she clerked. And, you know, her idea is this notion of original meaning, which is tied to the idea of textualism. And in essence, what it asks of us and asks of judges is, you know, you want to look at the words of a document like the Constitution, you know, using what a reasonable person at the time of the ratification might understand it to mean. And there are critics of this because the argument is that we really ossify the meaning of the Constitution because we might be stuck in the 18th century or the 19th century and not really have a good grasp of how it would apply today. But others would argue that that's very much in line with democratic theory because we want to make sure that this contract that we created, the Constitution or even the statutory provisions we create, mirror what was meant by those who wrote it. And if we don't do that, then we're giving a bunch of unelected judges the opportunity to say whatever they want and invest their own ideas and ideology. So it's a fraught kind of debate. But you know, Jim's position is one that is sort of winning the day among conservatives, which is we have to return to first principles and try to understand what the founders meant by their words in the Constitution.
Thanks for the call, Jim, at 800-642-1234. Nate is with us now in Mauston. Nate, hello.
Thank you. First of all, I want to say that the idea of originalism, I followed this, and I think this is a totally bogus idea. It can be manipulated by any judge, any way they want to come out with whatever interpretation they want. They just manipulate the words. So that's totally bogus. More important, what is at stake here, and I would favor consideration of increasing the Supreme Court, because what you have is Mitch McConnell brazenly using, and the Republican Party brazenly using, their authority and their power to do whatever they want to the Supreme Court. And the Founding Fathers never envisioned the power of political parties the way we see them today. I think the guest will attribute. And that, therefore, in order to have a voice to the people based on what the elections will say, slash Biden maybe being elected, he needs to have a voice for all the millions of people who voted for him, not just the grab that Mitch McConnell wants to make.
Nate, thanks a lot for the call. Well, that going back to the founders' intent, yeah, they didn't know what a political party was, at least not in the sense we understand it today, right, Charlie?
Right, and you know, there's a lot to unpack in what Nate offered us, and on the issue he raises with originalism. You know, it's funny that there's a famous article written by Justice Scalia, who's really sort of the founding father of originalism as we know it in its modern form. And the title of this article he wrote was Originalism, the Lesser Evil. And it implied in that title is that in and of itself, originalism is still evil. I mean, there's still problems with it, and he recognizes it. And in fact, he often called himself a faint-hearted originalist because he understood that sometimes you couldn't really discover what the text meant, or you were bound by precedent and you couldn't escape that. So that he understood much of what Nate is offering us, which is it's as problematic as almost any other approach you take. And you know, what's interesting about his second comment about Mitch McConnell is that, you know, from about 1900 to 1967, only one nominee to the court was defeated. out of 43 that were put up for nomination. And that was because of significant bipartisanship that existed at the time. And so we've really seen an erosion of that kind of comity that exists in the Senate to try to support what appear to be appropriate nominations by the President of the United States.
Thanks for the call. Rick joins us now in Rhinelander. Rick, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Yeah, my question is about originalism, this sort of rigid interpretation of the Constitution. If one were to take that as the actual intent, Article 2 of the Constitution only uses pronouns like he in regard to the president. If that were the case, clearly the originators of the Constitution, the signers, intended for only males to be able to not only occupy elected office, but to vote. Ultimately, the Constitution was amended in the 20th century to allow women to vote, but nothing, there was no amendment that allowed them to hold elected office. So if you were to take this originalism to what the intent of the founders was, no woman could right now run for the office of the presidency.
Rick? So thanks a lot. We're running short on time. I wanted to bring Charlie in that. Could we get that literal, I guess, with our constitutional originalism?
Well, and Scalia has written about this, and he said, you know, he distinguishes himself from a literalist. But, you know, Rick does make a good point, because if you are honest with the idea of original meaning, and I want to make that distinction between original intent, because we're talking about what people thought it meant rather than what the drafters intended it to mean, you do get stuck. And even Scalia would sometimes admit, sometimes you just have to ignore originalism for what would be a more appropriate outcome. And that would probably be his argument about overcoming those male-centered pronouns and the problems with property ownership of slaves and those kinds of issues that existed. So, again, it's the problem with being a faint-hearted originalist. If you are absolute in its application, it probably won't work.
In our last minute or so, Charlie, this is expected to be a speedy process. I think Senate working through the weekend, confirmation maybe exactly 1 week out from Election Day. What are you watching for if there's any kind of drama in how and whether that's going to happen?
I mean, quite honestly, I don't think there's going to be drama up to that point. The drama comes after she's sworn in. There are some big cases that she will tackle immediately, including the Obama care case that is front and center, and some others that might be a little arcane but are still central to our understanding of the power of the presidency and other offices at the federal level. So to me, this is the easy part. Buckle up for the rest.
Charlie, thanks again for joining us.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Charlie Jacobs is a professor of political science at St. Norbert College. We talked to him today about the vote to send Judge Amy Coney Barrett and her Supreme Court nomination to the full Senate for a vote. Wisconsin's presidential primary back in April was a little chaotic and confusing for many voters. 6 months later, many election officials across the state are changing how they do business, hoping to avoid the same problems in November. But as WPR's Laurel White reports, officials are still facing some uncertain circumstances.
Wisconsin's April election happened during a challenging time for the state. The coronavirus pandemic was in its early days. On March 25th, Governor Tony Evers issued his Safer at Home order less than 2 weeks before Election Day.
Wisconsin Governor Tony Evers just made staying at home an official order. All non-essential businesses are set to close their doors and the almost 6
people were trying to figure out how to vote by mail, many for the first time in their lives, and the ballots they requested weren't arriving fast enough. Lawsuits were flying, which led to even more frustration and confusion for voters. Now, 6 months later, election officials are trying to help things go more smoothly. That's why Tom Poppy is standing in a city park pavilion on a recent Saturday afternoon. He's next to a rowdy basketball game and a playground. Poppy is wearing a bright yellow vest with the city clerk's seal on the back. He's a poll worker for the city of Madison, and he's providing a new service for voters.
We're actually allowing them to bring their absentee ballots here that they have already filled out, and they have signed it, and they have a witness.
The event, held on two October weekends, is called Democracy in the Park. Jennifer Bellheimer walked her dog to the park to turn in her ballot.
As much as I like to support USPS, I guess I'd rather just drop it off here. with a known, you know, poll worker, and it's in someone's hands.
Wisconsin law allows voters to request their ballot as late as the Thursday before Election Day, with just 5 days to receive, complete, and return it. But the U.S. Postal Service recommends people mail completed ballots at least 1 week before they're due. In Wisconsin, that's 8 p.m. on Election Day. The space between what state law allows and what the Postal Service says is possible is causing some party officials a lot of angst this fall. Party officials like Ben Wickler, the chair of the Democratic Party of Wisconsin.
We just want to say, go, go, go. Let's do this. Let's do this early, and let's get those ballots in.
In April, almost 80,000 ballots arrived at clerk's offices after Election Day. But because a federal court granted a 6-day extension for clerks to receive ballots, they were still counted. Democrats and several advocacy groups have filed a lawsuit to get a similar extension for November's election. So far, they haven't been successful. In general, polling suggests Democrats are more likely than Republicans to vote by mail. Ron Bishop is the chair of the Republican Party at Fond du Lac County.
A lot of people just prefer the traditional show up on Election Day, go to the city hall, get in line and vote.
Bishop took some heat from Republicans for pushing back against President Trump's criticism of mail-in voting. Over the summer, Bishop said his nightmare scenario would be a surge in COVID-19 cases this fall that would scare some GOP voters away from voting in person after they'd already bypassed voting by mail.
It's creepy how that premonition is kind of turning out to be true.
It's true in the sense that COVID cases are surging in Wisconsin. It's impossible to predict who may bypass voting in person on Election Day and why. According to the Wisconsin Elections Commission, more than 1.4 million people have requested mail-in ballots for November. With about a week and a half until Election Day, about 900,000 have been returned. Many communities are now offering ballot drop boxes for people wary of Postal Service delays ahead of Election Day. In-person voting began Tuesday, so many clerks are now offering that option to vote or to register to vote. They have masks, hand sanitizer, a boatload of disposable pens. They all learned hard lessons in April, and they're determined not to repeat history. Laurel White, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up, we'll take a look at the media coverage of the ongoing Hunter Biden story and look at the way different outlets in the media and in social media have responded to a story out over the last week. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time, and tune into Wisconsin Public Radio or stream at WPR.org tonight. A live coverage of the last scheduled presidential debate between President Donald Trump, former Vice President Joe Biden. Coverage hosted by NPR's Ari Shapiro. That's coming up tonight. You're listening right now to Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Republicans on the Senate Judiciary Committee voted to subpoena the heads of Twitter and Facebook this morning. None of the 10 Democrats on the panel were there. They had protested an earlier vote on the nomination of Judge Amy Coney Barrett to the Supreme Court. The move comes after the social media companies had suppressed or limited links to an unverified story about Joe Biden's son in the New York Post. The New York Post reported on emails that were allegedly taken from a laptop that belonged to Hunter Biden. They suggested that he tried to introduce a top official at a Ukrainian energy company he worked for to his father. Joe Biden called the story a smear. No word on when Twitter CEO Jack Dorsey or Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg would actually testify. Other claims about Hunter Biden's business dealings have surfaced in recent weeks and months. Conservatives say the media has ignored those stories largely. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of the media's handling of the Bidens? Were Twitter and Facebook right to limit the spread of that New York Post article, or was that a sign, do you think, of anti-conservative bias? How much does this issue, Hunter Biden's business dealings, matter to you, and how should the media approach stories like this? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Jordan Foley is an assistant professor in the Journalism and Media Production Department in the Edward R. Murrow College of Communication at Washington State University. He earned his PhD from UW-Madison. He focuses on political communication and digital media. Jordan, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Well, before we dig into the twists and turns of this latest story, in general, you've got a son of a presidential candidate engaged in business dealings in other countries. In general, this is fair game for political reporting, right?
Certainly fair game for political reporting. I think the way that people go about covering the story is certainly the bigger question covering all of it. It's not as if stories like these necessarily come out of the blue. A lot of the Hunter Biden-related controversy stretches back all the way to April 2019 and the impeachment proceedings and phone calls between the Trump administration and the recently elected President Zelensky in terms of Rudy Giuliani reaching out to research these kinds of things. So it's not as if this hasn't been in the media already and sort of in that sense, certainly fair game for sort of political jockeying one way or the other, but certainly raises a great deal of questions for people who are tasked with reporting and communicating these things accurately to the people who are trying to decide who to vote for.
And Wisconsin Senator Ron Johnson, who chairs the Senate's Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs Committee, on Fox News last week, he talked about some of the deals, whether he was profiting off the Biden name, what the candidate Joe Biden knew about it. Here's a listen to the senator.
What astounds me is how the press continues to ignore this. You know, we issued our report and the press just ignored it. They said, well, there's nothing illegal here. Well, it's not my job to prove illegality. My job is to do oversight, get information to inform public policy, but also to inform the public. We gave the press, we gave the public a treasure trove of information that is very troubling, that is just crying to be investigated. And I think what we're starting to see now is the dam's breaking. People are coming forward with more information, and that's what's going to be required.
Is that a fair criticism? Do you think that the press didn't do enough coverage, including after Senator Johnson and his committee issued a report?
Well, I certainly think that the fact that, you know, people like me and you are on talking right now is evidence that that's certainly not the case. And even after social media companies did engage in activities to either limit the spread or distribution of those links, there were still millions and millions and millions of people sharing these stories. And to the extent that people, again, you know, focus on the details that maybe the authors of the report wanted people to focus on, I don't necessarily think they're entitled to that. But, you know, in terms of how people make decisions about how to cover these issues and whether or not they want to cover the sort of speculative nature of things that need to be investigated more to create more verified accounts of maybe what it is that we're exactly looking at are certainly part of the conversation. But I think a lot of the reporting that at least I've seen focuses a lot on the backstories and sort of, you know, how does a news organization come to publish something like this? What kinds of conversations were happening in newsrooms? Where did this story come from? And what can we say about the nature of the information within it? And I've seen quite a bit of reporting and commentary as far as that goes. And the report that was put out by the Senate certainly contains a lot of qualified allegations and pointing to to certain things that that Senator Johnson describes as troubling and need to be investigated. And certainly there is a lot of questions about getting more information and transparency with regard to the story itself and the information within it. And I think journalists have been doing quite a bit of work to attempt to suss those out. And some of the decisions to not run the story that the New York Post decided to run were informed by those exact same principles of attempting to suss those things out. I don't think it's necessarily the media's obligation to fan the flames of speculation around unverified claims where reporters and people and experts surrounding these issues have legitimate concerns about the nature of allegations that you might be able to make at this point, especially considering the timing.
Talking to Jordan Foley from Washington State University, looking at media coverage of stories related to Hunter Biden. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Jordan, let's get into this story that mainly prompted this conversation, the New York Post article we've both mentioned. Allegedly, these laptops, depending on which version of the story, show up. And it's a difficult spot for the media because, okay, there's this information out there. It's in one outlet, but a lot of stages of the story would require, it seems like, some more verification. How can a news outlet, especially say a national news outlet, 2 weeks before an election, what's the responsible way, do you think, to try to handle a story like that?
Well, I think that when you're considering covering something like this, especially the nature of the allegations that are involved and certainly the kinds of narratives that are being spun around it, one thing that I would certainly suggest is, as I mentioned, you know, going back to where these stories really started. When did Hunter Biden really become a component of our political discourse? And as I mentioned, these issues extend all the way back to reporting that was happening around the time of the impeachment trials to begin with. We have a lot of information and public reporting associated with Rudy Giuliani, his dealings with Ukraine, the investigations that he's sort of carrying out around those spaces. And so I think in terms of thinking about how to approach covering these issues, that context is crucially, I think, important for telling the story of not just a hard drive that randomly showed up that may or may not contain a treasure trove of information that may be politically beneficial or not to one side or the other, but giving listeners and readers a chance to understand the context of where the story is coming from to begin with, and what is it that we do know that we can verify, that we can say about these things, and making sure that even as we're communicating the fact that people are disagreeing about them, that there is some level of responsibility taken for the kinds of information that is sort of being passed along and can be verified. Noting when these things are unverified is certainly a component of it. Headline writing is certainly something that should be a component of it. I think one thing that makes these things get a lot more press than normal is because it's likely that people are reading headlines and short bits rather than full stories. And so making clear decisions about what kinds of information is legitimate to be highlighting from a story like this and what the real story is and being able to communicate that fairly effectively. And I think in terms of, you know, broadly thinking about covering stories like this, thinking about it in terms of not covering it as a political episode, but covering the themes that have emerged across a campaign that's been reported on for months and months and months now, that we're not just starting from scratch with a story like this. And that we have quite a bit of context to provide readers and listeners to understand not just the unverifiability of many of the central claims in a lot of these stories and the nature of the speculation, but also what we do know about the way that these stories come to be in the first place.
Another concern for media, and as we've seen social media outlets, is are they in effect amplifying disinformation campaigns? We know they're out there. We don't know if this is one of them or not, but we're in a landscape where foreign actors, domestic actors may be trying to spread stories that are false or only partially true. Do you think the media needs to be more wary these days?
Well, they certainly need to be more wary these days about the kinds of information that they pass along. I think in particular for social media companies, they're in a really difficult circumstance. Obviously, you have the subpoenas of Jack Dorsey and Mark Zuckerberg to come testify about the nature of the sort of bias on the platforms that they run. And especially when you're running a platform that contains so much user generated content and things like that, the amount of responsibility that we're asking private companies to take on to monitor these very complex information environments makes it really difficult for people to have a transparent understanding of exactly what's going on. Jack Dorsey even came out and declared Twitter's own handling of it to be relatively unacceptable in terms of the clarity with which they talk about the way that they limit the spread of issues like these. So in some ways, it's about being wary. In other ways, it's about being very transparent with your readers, either when you make mistakes or make high stakes decisions about what kinds of content to throttle access to or limit access to. in terms of those. And those are certainly things that Republicans are concerned about, but perhaps more from attempting to make it more of a legal and constitutional issue rather than what it sort of really is, which is about ethics, politics, and the nature of media regulation more broadly.
We're talking about the media's handling of Hunter Biden's business dealings. Jordan Foley is our guest, assistant professor of journalism at Washington State University. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think the story has been undercovered? Is the media treating it fairly? Do you worry about a false, a mis, or disinformation making its way through the media? Call 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation and hear from you coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking about the media's treatment of Hunter Biden's business dealings, Ukraine and China, and how media and social media have handled a report from the New York Post. Jordan Foley is with us from Washington State University, assistant professor of journalism and media production there. You can join in at 800-642-1234. We'll go to your calls. Brian is with us in Wausau. Brian, hi.
Hi. So there's a couple reasons why this story is absolutely ridiculous. First of all, the original author of the Times story wouldn't even put their name on the article. They ended up having to put two different reporters' names on the article. The first one, as of April, worked at Fox News and has connections to Roger Stone and Steve Bannon. The second one didn't even know their name was on the article until they saw it in the paper. More importantly, though, the whole thing was propagated by Rudolph Giuliani and Steve Bannon in the first place. Steve Bannon, who's on federal charges right now for fraud. I mean, how can anything he says even be trusted anymore, if you could even trust him in the first place?
Brian, thanks a lot for the call. And he's referring to reports on the reporting there, Jordan, other news outlets trying to track down the provenance of the story and how it ended up at the Post.
Yeah, the story that I believe your caller is referring to is there's a great New York Times story with it's pretty well sourced in terms of the internal strife at the New York Post in terms of who was getting credit and who wasn't, who was writing it, who was willing to sort of take on those things. And I think those are all incredibly legitimate questions when it comes to reporting on stories like this. And ultimately, I think are really great opportunities for people to get a better insight into how journalists in newsrooms make these kinds of decisions, seeing the kinds of what kinds of information would be asked for a journalist if they wanted to put their name next to a story like this. And certainly, as the caller mentioned, credibility concerns associated with the sources from the story, I think gave people understandable pause even within the organization about how to ultimately handle the story.
Thanks for the call. We'll go to John now with us in Medford. John, hello.
Hi, thanks for having me. I do not feel that the story's being undercovered. I feel it's been covered up. And if Hunter's last name was Trump, I think that the mainstream media would be shouting it from the rooftops 24/7. They have the laptop. I don't think it's about Hunter. I think it's about, as he's referred to, as the big guy is Papa Joe getting 10% for all these dealings.
John, thanks a lot for the call. John, referring to some of the claims that have come out of this there, but John saying the media wouldn't be so reluctant to do this if it were someone in the Trump family involved in the story. What do you think?
It's really interesting, and I think your callers are touching on important things, which is, you know, these assessments of whether or not there is appropriate amounts of coverage equitably across people, across the political spectrum. And these allegations of bias are such a longstanding component of not just election campaigns, but American politics more generally. And I think what we're seeing in these back and forth claims between conservatives saying that people are trying to censor them and not get the story out, and people from the other side saying we're really just trumping up a lot of stories from people who have questionable political backgrounds and maybe, as your caller mentioned, are facing charges of some sort for fraud, that those kinds of allegations both back and forth are incredibly difficult to verify and come to an agreement about. And part of that stems from, again, as I mentioned, the transparency that we get from the companies that control this kind of information, and fundamentally how we sort of, you know, since we've been dealing with since the 2016 campaign, what's the nature of the political truth? How do we come to decide it? And how much are those painted by the political predispositions that we may have going into assessing the evidence itself? So it really creates intractable problems for people who are in the media trying to generate unbiased coverage, and for social media companies who are attempting to regulate third-party content and posts that they have to sort of adjudicate while you know, maintaining the kinds of business and political and social relationships that they need.
Thanks for the call. We'll go to Laura now in Kenosha County. Laura, hi.
Yeah, hello. I think that these are basically the distractions. They're put out there so that the press focuses more of the precious time of election coverage on this subject. I mean, Hunter Biden's emails, it's ridiculous, especially so close to the election. And rather than concentrating more on the things that the American people might be interested in, like our president and what he's hiding from the American people as far as his releasing his taxes and stuff. I believe he's afraid to.
Laura, thanks a lot for the call. Jordan, that also raises the question of, I guess, of proportionality, how much weight you put on stories you cover, one candidate or another, one issue or another.
Absolutely. And you know, when you talk about how much coverage you can really get on one side or the other, I think there are a lot of people who think of that in terms of whether or not we're covering them the same amount, whether or not someone is, you know, getting the same amount of minutes on the air. And you see the same kinds of conflicts come in when you talk about fact checking more generally, in terms of are we checking facts of people too much? Are we giving them too much coverage? And there's plenty of research that suggests the amount of free media that Donald Trump and his campaign received in the 2016 election. And as your caller mentions, there are certainly incentives that people have, particularly in the month of October prior to an election, to create controversy that maybe perhaps distracts from weaker components of another candidate. And so I do think it really strikes at the heart of, you know, what are the things that matter to the people who are about to go to the polls? Do people really care about Hunter Biden's emails? And if some of the allegations in either the Senate report or these stories are true, what does it say about what we would be doing if we did care about those things as much as we purport to in terms of what voters ultimately care about? If we're concerned about these suspicious activities reports alluded to in the Senate committee report on Hunter Biden's transactions, well, then we might be more interested in the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists uncovering FinCEN files that have thousands and thousands of suspicious activities reports from a number of politicians that may illustrate exactly what your caller is talking about. And so I do think that when we talk about that episodic versus thematic understanding of what these stories are really about, that thematic focus really might be able to refocus, you know, who the center and the protagonist of these stories really is, which should ultimately be, especially in this context, voters and what their interests are and what really matter to them. And I think it's incredibly important to be discerning about the extent to which we're covering things because political media elites are putting pressure on people to cover the things that they want them to cover, and what that coverage is ultimately for, which is informing voters and letting them know so that they can make informed decisions about who to vote for come November.
Time for one more call. I think Charlie is with us in Platteville. Charlie, hi.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. When you first introduced the story and the guest this afternoon, the issue of whether the media was conservatively biased and censoring maybe some of the things that relatively come from the conservative. One of my questions would be then, do we have that same problem coming from liberal sides of the argument that they are complaining about their stories being squelched? But I think the real story, excuse me, and the issue has to be what is truthful, whether it's conservative or liberal, whether it's accurate or not. And I'm wondering what our guest says about how to confirm whether it's accurate versus we just want to get a dramatic story out because it gives us viewer ratings.
Interesting, Charlie. Thanks for the call. Jordan.
Well, I think your caller points to, I think, a really crucial important thing, which is that the purpose of all of this reporting should be to suss out the truth. I mean, whether or not we're covering one person more than the other should be somewhat secondary to whether or not we're, providing factual information. And to the point being made, are we following a sensationalist story, or are we doing the work to really track down the facts? I think that's what a lot of media organizations are trying to do. And I imagine many of them were pitched this story and decided to turn it down because they were unable to do so. And that story didn't really make it out. And many of them, in light of not being able to get more information about this hard drive or its contents, because the center of the story revolves around political actors who are in control of the information that contains all of the salacious material, it makes it very difficult for a journalist or someone from outside to really pry into what really is the truth there. And so I think that's why when journalists and other media members make decisions to say, okay, we have these unverified claims, and we certainly have a deadline for a story that we need to get out or write, that what do we really have time to focus on? What can we get out there that is truthful, accurate, and provides enough context so that when our viewers and readers do see these claims elsewhere, that they have enough information to make actually an informed decision about exactly what your caller was mentioning, which is, what is the truth? Can we suss that out? And can we separate our own political affiliations or biases from the underlying content of the allegations and the scandals that we really want to make the center of our conversation prior to an election?
Jordan, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
That's Jordan Foley, assistant professor of journalism and media production at Washington State University, looking at the media's treatment of the ongoing Hunter Biden story. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. And then, do math problems give you anxiety? If so, you're not alone. We'll talk about how to get more comfortable with numbers and how we can make them less intimidating for kids along the way. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time.